Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. In this episode, Ino Corey and John LeDrew discuss Ino's recent book, Retrospectives Anti-Patterns. They cover different ways to handle retrospectives and common pitfalls to avoid. Created for developers, by developers, GoTo gathers the best minds in the software community. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in Chicago, Amsterdam, and Copenhagen, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Hi there, I'm John LeDrew, and I'm an Agile coach.
Hi there, I'm Ino Corey, and I'm also an Agile coach.
Well, hi, Ino. It's nice to see you.
So nice to see you too, John.
in strange circumstances, but it's still nice to see you.
Yeah.
So I believe that that you've written a book.
You're right, I have.
I know, and amazingly, for us just to bump into each other, I have a copy as well. And as I've known you a little while, I also know, and you know, that we both have miraculously an interest in agile anti-patterns. And I was just thinking back to when we, well, not when we first met, but when we met up, I think it was GoTo Chicago a few years ago?
Yeah.
What I found interesting was that I delivered a workshop on psychological safety. And then immediately afterwards, I think the second day or the third day, you were doing a workshop on retrospective anti-patterns. And I gate crashed your thing because it was raining. And I decided Chicago was best when it wasn't raining. Although it shows how little I know about Chicago, because I think that gives me about 2 days a year to actually see it. But I gate crashed. And what was really interesting was, firstly, I think three or four of the people that were in your workshop had attended mine. And what something that struck me when I was in there was actually how much crossover there was between psychological safety and retrospectives, for obvious reasons, I think. But could you maybe go into that a little bit? Because obviously a huge amount of when I was going through the book, there is this underlying thing to me, which seems in almost all of the anti-patterns, that there's this underlying thread of safety being really important. And that's something that's really important to me. And I was just wondering if you could expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, I think that first I have to say what I believe psychological safety is. And to me, psychological safety is not to feel comfortable all the time, but to be comfortable even in uncomfortable situations. So that you can go into a situation where there's some sort of conflict or where there's people who disagree on things and you have to do something for the first time and you can still feel okay with it. To me, that's psychological safety. And I agree that there's a huge overlap with how to do good retrospectives. There are many ways of facilitating retrospectives, but I am aware that some ways are better than others, which is why I wrote the book. And the thing about feeling safe in a retrospective is really important, because the point with the retrospective is that as a team you should share and appreciate and learn from what has happened. And if you don't feel safe, you might not want to share the things that didn't go very well, because maybe you want to cover up that something went wrong, you made a mistake, or you were afraid or sad about something somebody said. And also, it's very difficult to appreciate what happened. And with appreciate, I mean both appreciating in the positive and the negative sense, acknowledging that these things happened and it actually didn't make us a better team. And I think you're not really able to acknowledging that in honest unless you have the safety. And then the last thing about learning, I think it's really important to learn to feel safe. And that's also something that I apply a lot when I'm teaching at the university, is that if the students don't feel safe to ask questions, if they don't feel safe to say there's something they don't understand, then it's very difficult to learn.
That's really interesting. So there's a couple of things that stuck out there for me. The first one around being kind of comfortable, almost being uncomfortable. And that's something that I really, certainly in my own practice when I'm delivering retrospectives and anyone anyone that has been in a retrospective that I've facilitated, I think, in the last 4 or 5 years will testify to this, is that a lot of the practice is actually creating safe discomfort. And what I mean by that is often that thing whereby, a nice story is I delivered a retrospective where I'd done a game called Animal Lineup at the beginning. And this game involves you tell everyone as they come in the room, you just say, think of an animal along with a sound and an action, but keep it secret for now. And they all come in the room, obviously completely freaking out, obviously, about what on earth this is going to be about and what I'm going to get them to do.
Yeah.
And then when they're in, you might have done some other safety check exercise first, and they probably all feel really unsafe because I still haven't told them what the hell I'm going to do with this animal thing. And I just say, you know, to their horror, or I just want you to line up in order of your animal size. And what I'd like you to do is the only way you can communicate is with the sound and the action that you came up with. And obviously what happens then is hilarious because then there's all of these interesting social things that happen, which is that they get into the need to, they all do it even though they feel really uncomfortable, because the majority will do it because it would be really uncomfortable for them not to. And they do it anyway, and they all get there, and then you'll have some people kind of walking around. I normally love seeing somebody will kind of walk up to someone and go, meep, 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 and they'll be replied with, rawr, like this or something. And at one point, I remember two people were kind of stood in front of each other going like this. And I just wandered up and said, all right, you can talk, what's going on here? And he said, well, we're just trying to work out what's bigger, an Indian or an African elephant. I was like, so I'm amazed that you even had any of that conversation going on. I'm guessing you now know what the context of this conversation is. So after this had happened, it was very funny, lots of people laughing. Right at the end of the retro, and we had actually had quite an interesting conversation where one of the team members had given kind of really good but quite difficult feedback to somebody else on the team, specifically that they'd made jokes that made a lot of other people feel a bit uncomfortable. And they'd had what was actually a direct but very respectful conversation about this in front of the team. And afterwards, I'm clearing up, and one of the guys comes up to me, this old dude who's this guy in his mid-50s. He's like, I don't know in European measurements, but he's about 6'8", which I think is, you know,
that's tall. Like, in European measurement, that's tall.
Yeah, very tall. Yeah, even by European standards, even by Scandinavian standards. Yeah, yes, that's the exact European standard.
Yeah,
it's the and he's very this kind of tall guy from Essex, and he just goes,
"Gore, John, these retros, they're almost emotional,"
like this. And he goes,
"But I guess once you pretended to be an elephant in front of your peers, anything else goes, right?"
And I remember thinking after we spoke about it, I was like, that's absolutely right. Which is what actually seemed to happen was that what we ended up creating with some of these silly games. And I know we've both done kind of similar warm-up style exercises at different times, is that you create these situations that are really uncomfortable but perceived as being really socially risky, but actually they're not. It's like they're not really risky at all because everybody does them. But what you end up doing is by the time they come back to something that feels really safe in comparison, just giving feedback, it's like, which is actually something genuinely socially risky, which is what I find funny, is that giving direct feedback is really socially risky. But by that point, it almost feels safe now in comparison to pretending to be an elephant.
Yeah, that's but true.
To me, I don't know whether or not you've had a similar experience with kind of exercises or noticing that change in behavior when you do some sort of exercise.
Yes, I have several of those, but as you know, since my book is about anti-patterns, I prefer to talk about my failures, which I, and as it turns out, everybody else thinks is more fun anyway. So I'm definitely on board with having them do weird things and answer weird questions. And I, I explain to them that it's because I want to build trust. And if they build a relationship with each other, that's a huge element of trust to build that relationship. But one of the things that I remember that failed utterly for me is that I once had, it was a new team of men in an IT company many years ago. And the retrospective had been sort of negative. They'd been focusing very much on negativity, and which, I mean, it's understandable because they wanted to learn. But I think it's also a good idea to focus on the positive things that you want to do more of. But they had been a bit negative. So I thought in the end I would sort of cheer them up by having the appreciation game. So I made them all stand in a circle. And they didn't really like to stand in a circle because they thought, well, that's really weird. But I made them stand in the circle. And then I had a little ball with me, and I threw the ball to some of them. And then I said, so this is an appreciation game. So I throw this ball to you, and I appreciate you for something that you said earlier, which I think was great. And now you look around and you find somebody in your team that you want to appreciate. And then you say that appreciation and you throw the ball. It could be, thank you for helping me at that time, or thank you for always saying good morning, or thank you for that delicious cake, or thank you for that code review, or something like anything. It could be anything. And then the man who caught the ball, he sort of looked at the ball, and then he looked around at everybody else in the circle, and then he looked at the ball again, and then he just dropped the ball on the floor. And that did not create psychological safety in that retrospective. And I think that if it had happened now, I would have done something about it. But back then, it just really made me frustrated and sad and feeling really bad at facilitating retrospectives. So sometimes these activities and games, they can also fail miserably. And I think it's also important to say that to facilitators who are not that experienced yet, that you hear us making all these interesting, funny games, but sometimes they fail, and it's important to know what you do then. How do you get something out of that as well? How do you get on? How do you move on from that? And also sometimes they hear about a game or an activity and they want to do it because John did it or Aino did it. But if they don't really believe in it, then it doesn't really work for them, right? So you really have to believe yourself that it's a good idea to make them say an animal sound and an animal activity.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Should I be excited or afraid of AI? The answer is yes, it's both.
Things are going to look so different in the next couple years. You will not be ready for the disruptions that are going to come.
I'm Jeff Nielsen, host of Digital Disruption, the go-to podcast for technology leaders.
Our generation's conflict, I think, is going to be emotional, not economic.
The companies that are going to win are the ones that have a couple of characteristics.
Stay ahead of the curve with Digital Disruption, available now on your favorite podcast platform.
It's an interesting question that, like, how much of navigating our way as facilitators out of, let's just say, challenging situations like that, but how much of that is something that you kind of have to experience it, I think, almost. Like, I don't know whether, like, I can probably millions, thousands of times in a long time of facilitating, I've had, you know, difficult individuals, frustrating situations that I was able to navigate out of, and situations that, I don't know, I just walked out of.
Yeah.
Leaving the team. Who knows? Probably. But I don't think, in that era of continuous learning, I don't think that I could do. I think I learned from every single one of those, if you see what I mean. Like, I needed that massive discomfort of standing there with, for me, I remember it was a team member. We were just doing a simple check-in game, you know, say two words to check in. And the team member just said, what was it? He said, retrospective ROI.
It's a good start, isn't it?
It was, actually. I was just like, wow, this is going to be.
Yeah, well, I sometimes ask the people at the retrospective, so what do you expect to get out of the retrospective? And then sometimes if they say, I don't expect to get anything out of this retrospective, I'm like, oh, that's wonderful. You're making my job so easy. If you don't expect to get anything out of it. That's easy for me to accomplish, definitely. So trying to turn it into like a joke, I think, works as well sometimes. But I agree with you to an extent that it's difficult to learn from other people's mistakes, which is everybody who's been a teenager knows that you cannot learn from your parents' mistakes. You have to do them yourself at least one time. And yet then why did I write this book about anti-patterns, which is to make people avoid doing my mistakes? And I think that what you can get out of hearing about other people's mistakes is that maybe that you're aware that they're there, and perhaps you can do something at least to avoid or at least recognize when you're there. But also I think, and this is important, to know that other people, even experienced retrospective facilitators, have been in this situation. And you're not the only one. It's not because you are tremendously stupid or bad at facilitating. I mean, it could be, but that's not necessarily why these things happen.
I think that, to me, the interesting thing that I got from, I mean, maybe this is just from the same perspective as you in many ways, because I think as I was going through it, I was just kind of like going, oh yeah, I remember doing that. And, oh yeah, yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah, yeah. So it was kind of, but what I found refreshing, I guess, is that it's not, I mean, maybe it is just a book of, the funny thing is I didn't see it as a book of your mistakes. When I was reading it, I saw it as, I mean, maybe I just read it as a book of my mistakes.
That's okay.
Which is probably easy. No, but what I mean is I was reading it through more as seeing the, oh, I remember that situation. And then it was interesting to see how somebody else navigated their way out of that. You know, it's like, it's interesting seeing situations. Yeah, I mean, things are obviously very recently, and it's become more prominent, things like the peekaboo problem, you know, people not turning their camera on,
yeah,
which is such a big problem, you know, for right now.
Yeah.
And has become more of a challenge recently. And it was an interestingly, lots of people, when we had people that were remote on the particular client that I'm thinking of now, where they were people remote pre-COVID, they would turn their cameras off, and but actually they would often turn them on pre-COVID if they were remote, whereas now it's much more challenging for me to encourage people. But I find that it's like interesting seeing those, and kind of, I just saw them as oh great, something else for me to try, as opposed to, but maybe that is just the perspective of somebody that can recognize those challenges.
I think it makes a huge difference that you are as or even more experienced in facilitating retrospectives than me. I remember when the Gang of Four book came out, the one about the design patterns for object-oriented programming, there you could sort of divide people into two groups. There was a group of people who did not have a lot of experience in object-oriented analysis and design and programming, and they loved it. They learned a lot from it. They were like, oh, wow, all these things we want to try, and of course. And then they overdid it, right? And we had singletons in every single design. And then there was the other group of people who were experienced with object orientation, and they said, this is simple. This is trivial. We all know this before. And because of that, I'm happy that my book comes now 30 years later, because now people have I hope people appreciate that even if you read something in the book that you know, it can be worthwhile to have a vocabulary to talk about it. Now, you said peekaboo, and all the different names of the anti-patterns I think are important, because if people can talk about it, they can talk about things in a higher level of abstraction. And I can say to you, for example, that I ran into some personal problems a few weeks ago, and I was, you know, sometimes when you things just pile up on your head and you think, oh, there's this and there's this and there's this and there's this and there's this, and you feel so small and dark and insignificant and stupid and without any energy. And then my husband said, isn't there something in the book that can help you? And I was like, oh yeah, I'm in the soup. That's where I am. I'm in the soup. Both feet well planted in the soup. And I used the exercise, which is in the book, which I didn't invent, but it's in the book with the three circles about what you can do, what you can sort of influence, and what you just have to learn to live with. And that helped me, not out of my problems, but out of my sort of reaction to the problems. So I like that way of being able to communicate it. And now when I say that to you, you understand what I mean.
That's a really interesting point, actually. When it's something that I mean, obviously you know, our mutual friend, Linda Rising, and she's also quite a big fan of patterns.
Yeah, you can say that.
And we, yeah, you could, yeah, fan of patterns. And we, many of our conversations have spoke like that idea of, that the real value in patterns is that being able to give a name to something.
Yes.
And it's funny actually how that old, you know, the old programming joke of the, you know, the hardest things, you know, the whatever it is, the is it the three hardest things are naming things, cash invalidation, and off by one errors.
Or yes, two and off by things. One errors.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and so it was important for me to find good names for these, and some of the names just popped up because it was the way that I thought about all these problems. But some of the names I had to think about, and I'm not entirely sure that all the names are good. But what I felt was important as well in the book is that I have for every anti-pattern, I have like this little illustration with the red octopus. And I had an illustrator, Nicole Courage, who did those for me. And the reason why I wanted these illustrations is because in my teaching, I've learned now that some people react to text verbally and some people react visually. And if you're talking about a computer program, then a UML diagram is good for some people and the code is good for other people to communicate. I'm obviously you need the code at some point, right? But that's why it was so important for me to have an illustration for each of the anti-patterns, because for some people that will be the thing that sticks, that will be the way that they remember how to get out of this situation.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Now in its fifth season, Inspiring Tech Leaders is the podcast that talks about technology strategies, challenges, and breakthroughs shaping today's digital world. Each week, Inspiring Tech Leaders brings you technology reviews and interviews with visionary CIOs, CTOs, and industry pioneers. Whether you're leading a tech team or just love innovation, Inspiring Tech Leaders is your go-to source for inspiration and real-world advice. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform.
I think that I really love the illustrations.
I do too.
Yeah. I think it's a really interesting idea that need to be able to name things. And that's certainly something that I've taken from the book, looking through, to be able to go back and to be able to actually use these terms to describe these situations more tangibly, I think, to teams that I'm working with, because that's something that's really valuable. In that, I think there's a few of the ones that really stuck out for me, just maybe just because of your sense of humor as much.
Oh,
as
I'm really curious
else.
Now. I can't wait.
So I really enjoyed the description for. I'm just going to try and skip to it quickly. I have the book right here, and I'm trying to skip to it so I can find the exact.
Luckily, it's a short book, so it's easy.
Now where is the one that I liked? I think it was suffocating.
Yeah.
And what I liked about suffocating was in which team members get tired and hungry and unfocused during the retrospective, and the facilitator makes sure to feed them and give them oxygen.
Yes.
So that they can concentrate a bit more. I've definitely brought biscuits to retrospectives before, and cake, and I have occasionally brought lunch, and other things, general sustenance. Never before have I brought oxygen masks, though, not yet. And I'm just wondering if that was from a specific.
Yeah, I can see that. Maybe I should have reworded that a bit.
No, I like it. I like it.
But it's because, it's difficult to do something about it now when everything is online and you can't really change people's environment. But you could, the thing I have about that you don't prepare enough, disrespect of preparation, that you don't prepare enough for online retrospectives. In that email that you sent to people just before the retrospective, where I remind them to get some coffee and probably have a bio break if they need it, that's part of that suffocating in a sense, to try to make them aware that we are still bodies, even though we're only using our brains most of the time at the moment. And I definitely remember meetings that drag out and people are getting more and more tired and hungry and hangry and things are just spiraling down. And another problem is also if you're the one standing up all the time, then you don't notice how the oxygen is leaving the room, because you will get enough oxygen standing around huffing and puffing, but everybody else is sitting down getting more and more sort of tired. And
That's an interesting. So in a way, oxygen is an analogy for energy for you.
It is.
In that specific thing. Yeah, I just realized that when you were, so I get the, and I think that the, because that's something that I found really interesting as a facilitator, is the fact that I get, you kind of get, or at least I somehow find energy in the room when I'm facilitating.
Yeah.
And I almost don't feel tired while I'm facilitating, even if I'm going all day doing, I was facilitating a big 100-person, 2-department thing, retrospective thing recently. And I remember it went all day and it was like, it was 100 people. There was lots of people management and shuffling people around. There was only me, obviously. I was sole facilitating this thing.
That sounds really hard.
So by the end of the day, I was a bit dead, but I didn't feel it until I got home, which was still an hour's journey from the venue we were at.
Yeah.
And I remember getting home and almost just, I think I sat down on the sofa just to kind of got in the house, and I think I just fell asleep.
Yeah.
But I found that that's a really interesting observation, that you don't notice that because you're stood up and you're moving around.
Yeah.
And you don't notice the energy.
The adrenaline keeps us going, but also if we are standing up and they're sitting down, the difference is perhaps telling about who will notice the lack of oxygen in the room or energy in the room quickest.
How do you are there things that you've done to help manage energy? I tend to get people to move around just randomly.
Yeah.
Sometimes
I tend to do that as well, but randomly, that depends on how well I know the team and who they are.
Yeah.
And I think perhaps as a woman in IT, not that I'm complaining because I'm having a grand time as a woman in IT, but as a woman in IT, if you meet a new team of very serious, hardcore coders, it is my experience that you have to have a reason for all the things that you ask them to do. So if I want them to get up and move around or say something, I need to have a reason for doing it. Of course, I don't do it unless I have a reason for doing it. So I consider we need some more energy in the room, so please just get up. But I would probably, at least with a new team, or if they're very serious, I would word it like, in order for you to still have your attention going and your brain's working, we should get up now and do something like this. And then if I know the team, and they're okay with me just doing weird things because they know it's in their best interest and not just because I take secret pictures and put them online when they look stupid, right? then I can just say, okay, now we just get up and go around the table and then we see if we get in the same chair, if we get in another chair. Or if we have an online meeting, it'll be like, go up and find something red and then show it to everybody else. Finding something red for me is pretty easy because I'm almost always wearing red and I have red glasses and red watch and things. So I'll probably choose a different color.
That's interesting. One of my facilitator that I trained at a client, she does yoga all the time. And she would basically, between every kind of section within the retro, would just be like, stretch.
Yeah.
And just the beginning, the funny thing is that the team knew her far better than they knew me, because that she'd been working with them for 5-6 years or something, and obviously I was a new intruder, and they didn't know, they didn't know her as like crazy facilitator. They knew me as crazy facilitator that got them to. And then they were kind of, I remember them commenting on, oh, that it was going to be great when, you know, I'll call her Julie, when Julie does the retrospective, because we won't have to do any of that mad crap that John makes us do. And the first thing she did was get them to do a yoga warm-up or something, or meditation or something. And I remember the faces were gold.
Yeah, and it's as if when we're grown-ups and going to work, it's not okay to understand that our body is also really important, and stretching and realizing that we need to go to the toilet and have some water, but also that little brain residue that you have in the brain when you go from one meeting to another, there's always something in the brain that's sort of still there. And if you really want to concentrate on a meeting, you should have some sort of mindfulness first. And if it's a team that I really trust and they trust me, we can just have, I mean, real mindfulness, where I said, just close your eyes for a minute and just be completely quiet for a minute. And then just think about what you're about to start with, or think about nothing. And if I can't do that, then I try to have that mindfulness moment, just asking everybody the same question, then going in around and having them answer that. And also, depending on what kind of team I have, it's sometimes I ask them, what was your last meal? That's really boring if it's in Denmark, because everybody eats the same. But if you have like a global meeting, then that can be very interesting. And as I say to people, you can always lie. I mean, if you're ashamed that it was McDonald's, just lie. It doesn't matter. But just thinking about something else will sort of take that brain residue away and will make their brains fresh for the new moment. So that's something I'm thinking about. And I thought even more about it when I started researching into how people learn, when I started teaching the teachers at the university. And I found that interesting, how you can accommodate people in a sense that makes it easier for their brains to get new material. And you can also destroy the possibility for them to learn something if you know what to do.
Yeah, I've always found that. I think that obviously is when you're coaching generally, whether it's in the kind of creating a learning environment in a retrospective or any other situation, is obviously learning is just foundational and teaching is foundational. And
yeah,
it's even outside of a formal academic institution.
Yeah.
But those differences and the ways different people approach and absorb information. And the thing I found interesting is that on the face of it, when you're teaching something like computer science, or when you're teaching engineering, or you know, how to build web services or whatever it might be, it seems like you're just trying to transfer information. And it's actually really easy just to give loads of information to somebody, you know. Yeah. In fact, they can do it themselves without any help from either of us. But understanding is a very different beast.
Yes.
And it's something that and that's where it's coming back to actually to kind of naming things and things like that, is where I found that really interesting, is that it is actually, I found an exercise actually I do in retrospectives, and I think we've done a similar thing, is around, you know, affinity mapping, when you're grouping the topics. Yeah. And one of the most important things around that is actually getting them to name the groups. So what I want you to do is, obviously somebody's a scribe normally, and discuss it as yourself. What are you going to name that group?
Yeah.
Because that's going to be the focal point for the conversation. Yeah. And if you find it hard to name, then maybe it's different groups. And does that really summarize it? And you get them to really think about the naming, and you can see some people just their heads start to overheat when they're struggling with it. But it's always the most valuable part of the exercise.
Yeah.
And I find it's the bit that helps draw the focus in. But then I often find that that's also the most challenging, can be the most challenging part to facilitate, for me anyway, just because people often disengage when they feel their brains warming up.
Yeah.
If you've noticed that.
Yes, I've noticed that. It seems to me like brains are lazy, right? They and it seems also a bit like it hurts, or it demands too much energy to change your brain, which is the same as learning something. That's the way I think about learning, is to change your brain. And then sometimes people avoid that energy consumption or the pain or whatever it feels like to them. And it's interesting, as you say, to see them reacting to a simple exercise like that by disengaging, because it feels uncomfortable for them to actually learn something. And I think that the thing about affinity mapping and giving those different groups a name is, so is this the process, is this communication, or is this technology, what is this really? It's a very good way for them to talk together and to learn together about what is this, all these different symptoms we see, what is actually the problem behind it. So in a sense, it's also a bit of a course analysis, which can be very difficult, especially if you're not really that keen on seeing the result on that course analysis.
Yeah, well, yeah, indeed, especially when they're often challenging things, that kind of organizational things, or challenging things that they don't really want to do, or they feel often, they often feel powerless to do things about them. One of the interesting ones in there is obviously that the curious manager, and I found that what interested me specifically about that was that I've seen both sides of that problem, which is that I've seen teams whereby they have absolutely by the book the curious manager that I would rather was not present. And then they have teams that really, and this is maybe still part of the symptom, but I think it's on their journey to kind of becoming more autonomous, is teams that felt and wouldn't actually discuss anything really of any value unless their manager was present, because they felt like everything that they could do needed his approval to be able to. It's like, well, we can't make an action without, you know, without Mr. Manager here, because he gives us actions. You know, they give us the actions. And that was, and I've seen both of those things where it was almost sort of, I realized that the manager needed to be there at least temporarily in order to create the safety for them to have those conversations. But I don't know if you've experienced a similar thing where we're with
I have. I've experienced it in several layers, so to speak. And one of the things that I often see is that if you have a team that has some problems that they keep popping up with different symptoms, then it could very well be one of the issues that you talked about, that it's the organization, or it's something the manager has decided that they can't do anything about. And in those cases, I'm asking the team, so do you want the manager to be present at the next retrospective, or perhaps do you want the manager to be present at the first half or the last half of the retrospective? Or sometimes I ask them, so do you want me to take these three post-it notes and give them to the manager to figure out what level are we on here? And then I've had huge backlashes from teams sometimes, where they said, oh, but we want our manager there. Our manager is our friend. It would be stupid. Why wouldn't we want our manager there? And I'm like, no. Why wouldn't you want your manager there? Perfectly fine. And in some cases, it was because it was a startup and they started together and he is actually part of the team, or she is part of the team. But it could also be in some situations where they don't really feel safe to say no to having the manager there. And then you have a different problem, right?
Yeah. I had an interesting one with a client that was a very, very big old company, very, very hierarchical culture. But what's interesting was that while the organization was still very hierarchical and kind of very affected by kind of old school, you know, scientific management, so to speak, the lower tiers, because of the regeneration program, the whole reason I was, you know, had been hired in the first place, was actually those kind of middle tiers of management were far more progressive and far more kind of open. And what was really interesting was that you had this interesting problem where the managers themselves were kind of completely safe to have in a retrospective, really, because they were there, completely there from a kind of, I just want to listen, and I'm not, you know, I just want to, I literally, as in not the curious manager, as in I want to mess with things, but literally I will be there and I will help. And they really would, you know, they were great.
Yeah.
But actually the team would still perceive them as the same way, regardless of everything, because they're so affected by the past realities that were very, very real for them. And I found that quite interesting, really, just that the kind of those differences.
It is interesting, because it's sort of a dissonance between how the manager perceives it and how the team perceives it.
Yeah, absolutely. The challenge between how the manager would see themselves as this wonderfully safe, I'm just here as, you know, and then the team see them as exactly the same person that has always been in that position. Do you know Tim Ottinger?
Yeah.
I remember we had a conversation once about doppelgangers and this idea that we create, you know, if you're rehearsing you're going to have a really difficult conversation with somebody, okay, so, and you know it's going to be challenging and you rehearse it in your mind, that thing where you kind of have the argument in your mind, but the person you imagine this person you're going to have this argument with or whatever is often like 10 times worse than that person ever would be in real life. Do you know what I mean? They're like screaming at you and probably getting violent, whatever else in your mind. And you're acting everything from, you know, in your imagination, you've done everything from kind of cower in the corner sobbing to kind of like dramatically storming out and slamming the door like some kind of, you know, with a big Hollywood exit. And you've done all of the ranges of things. And in reality, you know, this person's completely just fine. You know, a bit of a stern conversation and it's over and you come out feeling great. But that doppelganger idea is there's the real person and then there's the imagination, the image of that person. What we were talking about was how you might have the situation where a previous manager, someone in a role, has actually left the company, okay? A new person is now in that role who is very different from that previous person. But the memory of that other the person in that thing is still present and is still affecting people in it. I think it's a really interesting challenge because actually, obviously we're talking about retrospectives and actually I find that leadership structure, I mean, all about retrospectives are all about guiding teams. In fact, that's the main anchor point for autonomous teams in many ways. It's the main thing we do to change and to adapt.
Yeah, and it gives you team building and team understanding and everything. And I think it's interesting how, as you say, that people react to the role and not to the actual person. So if they've had a bad experience, then that is sort of the signals that they get from their body. They probably get anxious when they used to get anxious in that situation. And that's one of the reasons why I find it so interesting with a new team to make a futurespective at times. So a futurespective is where you draw a timeline from now until when the project ends or Christmas or a few months in the future. And then you say, well, imagine that you are here in the future and then what happened? Then put red, green or yellow post-it notes. The things that were great are on the green. The things that were bad are on the red ones. And the question marks are the things that were in between on the yellow ones. And then people say first, well, we can't predict the future. Why are you making us do that? That's really stupid. And I say, well, try to do it anyway. Let's try to do it. And then once they get started, they warm up to it normally. And then we have this wall of things that this went wrong and this was good. And then this person got fired or we got a new person on the team or something like that. And then what you do there is that you say, well, these are actually the hopes and fears that you have for this work together. So what we should do is that we should try to figure out how we can make the green ones that you hope will happen actually happen, and how we can avoid that the red ones that you fear will happen, make sure that they don't happen. And that is actually not because I think they can see into the future, but because I want to know what they've experienced before. As you said, they have like these experiences, and if they had a bad experience, they're worried it will happen again. So that's why I do it often with a new team, is because it gives me a way to look into their experiences, to look into their brain. If I just asked them, maybe they wouldn't have said it, but this is a bit convoluted and subtle. So suddenly they're sort of telling us about a lot of experiences they had that were good and bad. And I think that's an interesting way of learning about people.
Mm. So you're looking forwards, and that encourages them to look backwards, because obviously they can only predict the future with their past experience.
Exactly. Unless I've been really lucky with my team members in the retrospectives, that's always what's happened, is that they predict the future by looking back.
Yeah, unless you find that you're miraculously with a team that are in fact, you know, psychic.
And they can all, you remember the time we had Nostradamus in our team and we did the retrospective, like, boom.
Yeah, exactly. And you're just like, whoa, all right, well, that was inconvenient. This was just a trick to make you retrospect, you know?
Yes, exactly.
God, and you're all psychic. God, how
Stop
annoying.
Stop thinking so much about the future. We want to talk about what happened.
Yeah.
Yes, and I think learning about people and the team members learning about each other is very valuable, but also so that sort of points back to the thing you said about the manager. If they have a bad relationship with the manager, and it's not that manager's fault, so to speak, if the manager is genuinely sweet and trying to help them, it's probably something in the past.
Yeah, and it's very difficult to root those things out. It's really challenging, and that's when we end up moving into the role of like team psychologist. It sometimes feels like that, doesn't it?
Yeah, sometimes it feels like that. And then you also you run into this cognitive dissonance that I find so interesting in brains, that you can have this understanding of the world living perfectly in harmony with this understanding in the world. As long as those two never meet in the brain, you'll never find out that you actually have parts of your brains being completely disagreement with each other. And what you have to do then is you have to get it out in the open to make people understand that you believe this and this, and those two cannot both be true. It's something that I see in the teaching as well a lot, where some students of mine, they come to a class, like a programming class or something, with an understanding that they had in their mind, which is wrong. And then they go through my course and I talk to them and I have lectures and they have exercise. And then in the oral exam, it turns out there that they actually had these two understandings. And then they'll say, but you said that. I remember you saying that in one of the lectures. And I know I never said that. And I'm always on video, so I can look back. But it's interesting how the brain really wants us, in a sense, not to learn, and wants us to stay in the past. And that's one of the things that's really interesting with being that psychologist on the teams, is how can we work against that?
Cognitive dissonance is a fascinating thing, isn't it? Because it's like both our brains, it's like the least perfect defense mechanism ever, because it creates, it's like we build it as a defense mechanism, but then it creates massive internal conflict that was almost what it was designed to try and avoid in the first place, you know, and we end up, I mean, I find what's really interesting with that I've often seen is that problem around, it's even with things like, you know, whatever, making teams do silly things. And one of the interesting things around that is actually the kind of getting people into the child ego state, if you've, and one of the things that's really interesting I found anyway around that is this, is the perfect state to be in a retrospective, is that curious, non-judgmental child ego state where you accept everything. And it can be a really interesting thing where actually most people can get there, because actually most people, even the most serious, real, proper grown-ups, you know, do play quite a lot. It's just kind of, and that's their way of getting there. But it could be a real, what can actually be interesting is that you can see that it creates, for some people, it actually creates quite significant cognitive dissonance for them, especially in a work situation, because of the fact that it's like, you know, I think in the book, one of the stories you mention is around the peekaboo thing, around how one of the people that you mentioned had to keep this kind of complete work-life separation. You know, like there is no connection there at all. Yeah. I also find that really confusing, but I found that when you try to do anything playful in order to encourage people into that state, it can create this real problem if the identity that they have at work is a very fixed thing. And I think that people tend to do that, don't they? They create identities for themselves in different contexts, and it can
they do that. And I guess it's because they're afraid.
Yeah,
they're afraid that people will find out that they're actually just still kids with bigger shoes and huge house loans, right?
Yeah.
And because when I talk to people, when I teach teachers how to teach, or when I facilitate how to teach people how to facilitate, what the analogies I make are often with children you do this. And then at some point there's always somebody saying, why do you keep comparing grown-ups with children? And because they react in exactly the same way. They're just human beings. And the reason why I make the analogies with children is because it's something everybody can understand. Even if they didn't have children, they have been a child, I presume, again.
Yeah. I mean, they could have been placed here by aliens. You know.
And I've
I've met a few people that I strongly suspect this to be true of. You know.
And you're actually one of mine, John.
Yeah. I find that it's a really interesting thing around the that idea of the way we all react in the same way, because something that I found, and it's funny, it's kind of full circle, but we were talking about psychological safety, and something that I found is that when people aren't psychologically safe, well, when you're not safe, you're scared, you're fearful. Yes. And it's something that I've come to realize is that you can fairly reliably map like almost all of the dysfunctions that you frequently see within a kind of typical professional environment to fear reactions, you know, to fight, flight and freeze. And and that's especially true in situations where we're, as facilitators, creating uncomfortable situations often, or creating, even if we're not doing crazy things with the team, we're creating a situation that is uncomfortable simply because we're encouraging them to learn, you know, or encouraging them to introspect, or to think about the team, or to think about a failure possibly, or to think about a potential failure if it's a future spectre, you know, which might be the way they look at it.
Yeah, we have to do that. We have to put them in an uncomfortable state, because if this was so comfortable to them, they probably would just do it, right? Mm. And they obviously don't, which is why we need retrospectives. So my future hope is that people will actually talk to each other, share experiences, learn from that in a curious and open and positive way, and then we don't need retrospectives anymore.
I mean, that would solve a lot of problems in society.
Oh, yes. Don't get me started.
I'm imagining, because on the day that we're recording this, I think only a few hours, obviously, that a certain president is going to be departing the White House and a new one's going to be coming in. I'm just pondering now in my mind kind of that particular president sitting down in a retrospective facilitated by one of us.
I hope it's you.
Reg. Thanks. All right, I'll take one for the team. I know. I'll just imagining what the what that would be. Just kind of thinking about the last few years, you know, places for improvement.
Look back. Yeah. Can we learn from any failures? Problems. Did we say something that maybe hurt other people?
Failures?
Yeah.
Failures?
Maybe?
No. We'd have to be very careful about the language we'd use in order to make that situation psychologically safe, I think.
Definitely.
One of the things that I find, going back to what we were talking about, kind of the organization and that specifically in the soup, is certainly something that I found, and maybe this is where, as a coach, I'm frequently straddling this interesting line in as a retrospective facilitator, which is that in some cases, I am completely context-free and I'm literally just some team somewhere in the world says, come do a retro, and I go and do a retro and I have no idea what the hell they're going on about, and I'm just guiding them through to an outcome. And they're my favorite retros because they're like relatively stress-free and they're kind of easy in some respects. And then you have the other type, which is where I'm actively coaching this particular organization or team. And I do know loads of the context because I'm probably working with them actively on something, either on a specific project or at least within their team and within their, you know, within their circumstance. And then what I find is that while I can still facilitate, because I'm never a team member in the same sense, I'm very much straddling this line between context-free facilitator and consultant, you know, where I am looked upon to help solve this challenging problem. And they, you know, it's almost like they look to me for value for money, certainly if the manager's hovering nearby, like to present solutions or to help solve all their problems. And I find that one of the things that I'm able to do in that context is that when they find themselves in the soup, the solution is often for me to take an action to go and do something about it, because I might be able to go and march into the CEO's office and say, all right, you got a problem here.
You have an influence that they don't have.
Yeah, and that's a useful and sometimes a burden, actually, I find, because it can be difficult to... I feel like sometimes I'm in a situation where I'm creating learned helplessness, you know what I mean, by accident, because I end up going and solving it, but rather than helping them be empowered to go and do the job. But I'm wondering if you've seen similar things where I think sometimes when you're in the soup, the only solution is to kind of for us to get our hands dirty as a coach to help untangle or scoop them out, if that's the better analogy.
Yes, yeah, I agree. So if they're confronted with a lot of their problems being in the zoo, which is things that they don't have any influence on, and so normally what I say is that what you can do with these is that you can learn to live with it, you can learn to accept it, and you can adapt to that situation. But it's definitely true that sometimes these things would not be in my soup, they would be under my influence. And you should, of course, be wary of the learned helplessness. But I think that if you're aware of that as a facilitator, then you will be supporting them and facilitating them and sort of pushing them to figure out what is the most important problem for you to discuss right now. What are actions you could take, experiments you could try with this? And then in the cases where it is in the soup, then you must trust that they actually have emptied out any opportunity to gain influence on that, and then you can help them. And then I don't think you should feel that bad about doing that, because there's always enough problems. Yeah. Sometimes they can't see them, but there are always enough problems.
Indeed, always.
What I sometimes struggle with is not just solving their problems.
Yeah, well, that is... I think there's always that pressure, isn't there, as a coach especially, because you're seen as a... They're kind of like, especially for when you're seen as technical as well. It's like, well, you could help them solve this problem. It's like, well, I could, but you don't want me to.
Yes.
It's like what I normally say. It's like, yeah, we do.
Yeah.
We've just asked you to. No, you really don't want me to solve this problem.
Yeah.
It's like, what do you mean?
Yeah, it's a line. It's a line dance, right? You have to stay there, and at least I think in the actual retrospective, you should stay just as a facilitator, and then you could say afterwards, would you like me to offer you some help or some input on this? But once you start solving their problems as a facilitator, then as you said, that's what they will expect you to do. And every time they have a problem, they say, so what should we do with this kind of meeting? What should we do with this pull requests? What should we do with the code standards? And that's not what you want them to do. You want them to grow as a team.
There's one talking about when the facilitator is essentially too involved with the team themselves.
Is it like the do-it-yourself?
Do-it-yourself. Yeah, I think so. So when the teams are doing it themselves, essentially, and that it means the facilitator is just too involved. And that's something that I care a lot about. And I've often advised set systems up where teams kind of facilitate each other's retros and they rotate facilitators and things. But it's often a very big argument that I get from teams. It's like, oh, we can do it. And then you have the teams that go on about the ultra efficient ones where they do it themselves and they're over and done and dusted within half an hour and they always come out with actions.
Yes, they can be very efficient facilitating those retrospectives.
Yeah, which I always find really, it's really hard to comment on that. Because I feel like, just go, oh, that's brilliant. Well, you don't need me then.
Yeah, I think that in those cases, you can't really do anything about it in the moment. No. You just have to continue to give them a chance to show them what it can really feel like.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, although interestingly, what I found in some cases is I've gone in and facilitated, a correctly lengthed I don't know, 90 minutes or 2 hours retrospective to replace the half an hour. And then there's always like the three team members that thought, wow, that was so valuable and we got some stuff. Yeah, and there's a thing going, God, we just spent 2 hours in there. Bloody hell.
Yeah, but I think to evaluate the worth of the retrospective, it's not enough just to evaluate after the retrospective is done, but at the next retrospective to see what of these experiments, which did you do and what did you learn from them? I think that's the only way to really evaluate a retrospective, is to see the action points of the experiments. Do you get them done and what did you get out of them? And I think in those cases, you'll see there's huge difference between a very efficient one.
Yeah, indeed.
And a good one.
That's a really good point, because that's something that I've always said actually to teams when they talk about how we're valuing. I said, look, something to remember is the value of this retrospective or any other one is not here. It's what happens after the retrospective.
Yeah,
it's exactly. What, you know, these are the actions you're taking out. Well, the effort you put into as a team, you're able to prioritize doing something about these. Well, that's what's going to define how useful and valuable this is. Actually, the retrospective is valueless.
In itself, if nothing else happens.
Yeah.
And this is a good final statement for this interview. In itself, the retrospective is worthless.
Absolutely. Retrospectives, useless. Yeah.
Don't tweet this out of context.
I know Curry, author of says retrospectives are worthless. Done.
Anyway, it's been a blast talking to you again, John.
Yeah, it's been fun. Yeah, it's been lovely.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech for lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.